Iran blames U.S. excessive demands and refusal to lift anti-Tehran sanctions for the standstill in the talks to revive the 2015 nuclear deal. Iraqi security sources say two rockets have hit Baghdad's fortified green zone, which houses the U.S. embassy. And Russia reports 799 coronavirus-related deaths in an all-time high, as it has reached three times in the last month. Hello and welcome, everybody. Iran's ambassador to the Vienna-based international organizations has outlined some of the U.S. and its allies' excessive demands in talks on reviving the 2015 nuclear deal. Kazem Hadiwabadi said the U.S. has demanded talks on Iran's regional influence and its missile program conditional for lifting sanctions and the full implementation of the nuclear deal. He noted that the U.S. refusal to lift arms embargo on Iran is in clear contradiction with Security Council Resolution 2231. The Iranian diplomat said Washington has also refused to remove more than 500 individuals and entities blacklisted during the former U.S. administration. Hadiwabadi added the U.S. has also failed to give assurances that it would not repeat the behavior of the previous administration in case of the full implementation of the deal. Iran and the remaining signatories to the nuclear deal have been holding talks in Vienna since May. Political commentator Tim Anderson says the U.S. In the new talks on reviving the nuclear deal, seeks to weaken Iran and curb its regional influence.
Well, I'm afraid this was inevitable, that the JCPOA, properly understood, is never really about the nuclear industry or nuclear weapons. It's always been about Washington attempting to curb the influence of Iran in the region. And I think the U.S. officials have made that very clear now. And the Iranian official is now saying the obvious, that really there is too much at stake for the U.S. to try and drop any counter leverage they're trying to have against Iran in the region, and it's all about trying to limit Iran's support for defense of Iran and the support of the independent peoples of the region. Remember, things have changed in the last few years. Now, at one stage, the U.S. had Russia and China as well as the Europeans in this process. Now that's entirely changed. So there's no real incentive for Iran to make any sort of concessions to the U.S. It's really just about the U.S. trying to weaken the independent states led by Iran in the region.
Well, Muslims in the world are celebrating Eid al-Qadir. The festivity marks the appointment of Ali ibn Abi Talib as the first Shia imam. From Mashhad, our correspondent Yusuf Jalali is joining us now to tell us more about this special occasion and the significance that it harbors. Yusuf?
Well, Radia, where I'm standing is the holy city of Mashhad, and behind me is Gold Dome, which represents the holy shrine of Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad. And today is a very significant day for Muslims, and especially Shia Muslims around the world. It is called Eid al-Qadir. It marks the time, the day, of course, when 14 centuries ago, the Prophet of Islam raised the hand of Imam Ali and introduced him as the next leader of the Islamic world, the next caliph and the ruler of the Islamic world. He said that whoever I am, his mawla or leader, from now on, Imam Ali will be his leader. So this famous sentence is now, of course, repeated by these people here during their prayers in this holy shrine of Imam Reza. And the fact that the word Mawla in Arabic has several meanings and two important meanings. One of the meanings of the word Mawla is leader or ruler or a guardian. And the second meaning is friend. So this difference in the meanings of this word led to the creation of two major sects in the Islamic world, Shia and Sunni. So this is only a matter of interpretation of that word, Mawla. And you see that that slight difference in the meaning of the word and the interpretation of that word, Mawla, in Arabic, led to the creation of two different sects in Islam. Those different sects, Sunni and Shia Islam are brothers. They don't have any problems with each other. They are living peacefully in the Islamic Republic of Iran, and of course in the region, in the Middle East. But some countries are trying to misuse that difference in the interpretation of the single word 14 centuries ago to try to sow division between those brothers and sisters. So, but in fact, when you hear about the differences between the Sunni and Shia people, this is only a matter of an interpretation of the word Mawla 14 centuries ago. So there's no big deal, there's no big problem between these two sects of Islam. But traditionally, people in Iran from all walks of life on this important day gather and congregate at this holy shrine of Imam Reza in the city of Mashhad, praying, hearing, listening to, of course, eulogies about the personality of Imam Ali, who Imam Ali was, because to Shia people in Iran and across the world, Imam Ali represents justice, because, of course, after the Prophet of Islam introduced him as the next leader, that different interpretation of the word Mawla led to him waiting for 25 years to be able to become the next leader of the Islamic territories. So 25 years after the Prophet introduced him as the next leader, he became the ruler of Islam for almost five years. And during those 5 years, he tried to root out poverty. He tried to, of course, root out racial and sexual discrimination, and that has that led him to grow to be known as the leader of justice. Still today, people in Iran and across the world, Shia Muslims across the world, know Imam Ali as the leader of justice, as the symbol of justice. This is why people still, after 14 centuries, remember him, admire him for the things that he did for Islam, for the revival of the Islam that was introduced by the Prophet of Islam. Of course, the Prophet of Islam was the cousin of Imam Ali, and Imam Ali was the first person who, embraced by Islam. He was the first person who acknowledged Islam, the kind of Islam that was propagated by his cousin, the Prophet of Islam. So that is why the Prophet Muhammad introduced him as his successor at the time. Of course, he did not succeed to be the next successor, and 25 years after the demise of the Prophet of Islam, he became the next leader of the Islamic territories. So now people are gathering at the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza, gathering here inside the Holy Shrine of Imam Reza in the holy city of Mashhad. They're praying. They're, of course, listening to eulogies and admiration of Imam Ali. They're trying to teach their kids about the personality of Imam Ali, who Imam Ali was, why he was appointed by the Prophet as the next Mawla, or the next ruler, or the next caliph of the Muslim world. So, and interestingly, Imam Ali still inspires people. And many people, many families name their children after Imam Ali. So that is why the frequency of the name Ali, in Iran at least, is very high. So you see many people named Ali in Iran, that because they admire Imam Ali, and Imam Ali is highly revered in the Islamic Republic of Iran. So traditionally, people come here in the holy shrine of Imam Reza in Mashhad. Of course, they stay here for a couple of days. They even stay up the nights on Eid al-Ghadir, celebrating, you know, listening to eulogies, of course, read and recited by clerics who have better understanding of the personality of Imam Ali. They try to, of course, learn more about him and try to teach their kids about the personality of Imam Ali. So this is the importance of this day and the importance of the holy shrine of Imam Reza. Imam Reza was the eighth Shia Imam. He was one of the descendants of Imam Ali, actually. That is why Imam Reza, at the same time, receives as much attention and admiration by the Shia people in Iran. So today there's a big difference. And this year, there's a big difference in the way people are celebrating Eid al-Ghadir. Because of the coronavirus pandemic, there are fewer people attending and, of course, congregating at the shrine of Imam Reza. But, of course, there's still a significant number of people. But compared to previous years, you see a less number of people who attend the holy shrine of Imam Reza.
All right, thanks a lot, Yusuf. That was Yusuf Jalali joining us from the holy city of Mashhad. Elsewhere, two rockets have hit the Iraqi capital's green zone, which houses government buildings and foreign diplomatic missions. An Iraqi security source said the rockets targeted the heavily fortified area early Thursday. The source added that the attack caused no casualties or damage. No group has claimed responsibility so far. The source of the rocket is not yet known either. Baghdad's green zone has been frequently targeted by rockets in the past few years. Australia's biggest city, Sydney, has reported a record one-day rise in local COVID-19 cases despite an extended lockdown that is entering its sixth week. The state of New South Wales recorded 239 infections in the past 24 hours. State authorities also reported one more coronavirus fatality. The death toll from the current outbreak in the state has now risen to 13, and the overall infections to 921. Australia has been struggling to contain an outbreak of the highly infectious Delta variant in and around Sydney in recent weeks. The city has been under a lockdown since late June. However, state authorities say further measures will be announced as current restrictions show little sign of efficiency. New South Wales police say they've asked for 300 military personnel to help enforce lockdown orders. Russia has reported record high coronavirus deaths, registering 799 fatalities in the last 24 hours. This is the third time in the last 1 month that Russia's COVID fatalities break the record. The country also confirmed more than 23,000 new infections during the same period. Russia's overall cases now stand at more than 6.2 million, while its deaths are nearing 157,000. Authorities blame the surge on a more contagious Delta variant of the disease. However, despite the surge, no tough retractions are imposed across the country. Russia's vaccination campaign is also progressing slowly as there is a public reluctance to get vaccinated. In this segment of the program, senior U.S. and Russian officials have held talks on arms control and other strategic issues in an attempt to ease rising tensions between the two nuclear rivals. U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and her Russian counterpart Sergei Ryabkov led the talks in Geneva. After the meeting, Ryabkov said the U.S. showed readiness for constructive dialogue. He added that Washington wanted China to be included in wider talks on nuclear arms control. The two sides have agreed to reconvene in September. The meeting followed a verbal spat between U.S. President Joe Biden and his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Biden accused Putin of seeking to disrupt the 2022 congressional elections. The Kremlin, however, roundly rejected the claim. The two countries are at odds over arms control and cyber security, among other issues. Joining us on this edition of the News Review, we have journalist and political commentator Fred Weir, who's joining us from the Russian capital, Moscow. Also, we have research fellow at Global Policy Institute, Mr. George Samueli, who's joining us from Budapest. Gentlemen, welcome to the program. Let's start off with Mr. Fred Weir in Moscow. Give us your thoughts on the recent meeting that took place, and what are your expectations from this meeting?
Well, I think it's a sea change. It's so much better in the Trump era, where the president did say he wanted to improve relations with Russia to get along with Putin and all that, but it created pandemonium in the American political establishment. I suppose it wasn't entirely Trump's fault, but things got terribly worse, and even the bare bones of strategic stability wasn't addressed during those years. Everything got so much worse. And this is not to say that things are better across the board, but these kind of talks are clearly taking place. Strategic stability, arms control, it's perfectly plain that the Biden administration is making some pragmatic moves, like lifting the pressure on Nord Stream 2. Things that are just practical, they enable business to go forward and to ratchet back the tensions a little bit. It's the stuff about election interference and so on, a lot of the rhetoric will continue. We're in this era of history, the new Cold War or whatever they call it. It's not going away. But in this respect, these talks are quite reassuring and hopeful.
Mr. Samueli, give us your thoughts on the new Geneva talks. Mr. Fred Weir believes that maybe things are getting better right now between Russia and Washington with regards, in comparison to the previous administration. Many believe that Joe Biden took probably a harsher stance when he took office. How do you see it?
Well, that's a very good issue because, of course, remember during the election, Biden campaigned against Trump and accused Trump of being Putin's puppet. Actually, he used the term Putin's puppet. And Biden recycled every single nonsensical discredited accusation about the Russians, such as the Afghan bounty story and the rest of it. So, yes, you're absolutely right. That's all we were expecting. And I agree with my colleague. I mean, it's entirely a good thing that there should be the strategic stability dialogue. The problem is that the United States wants to use this these negotiations in order to curtail the edge that the Russians have developed with hypersonic weapons, with these nuclear-powered, nuclear-armed cruise missiles, the underwater drones, all these various areas in which the Russians have made a great stride. So, you know, United States wants to restrict that, understandably so. But the United States isn't prepared to make concessions that the Russians expect. And, of course, the big concession that the Russians expect is in the realm of strategic defense. And this is something Russians repeatedly say, that they want the United States to curtail its strategic defense buildup. So I don't think that very much will develop, and particularly in light of Biden's foolish statements the other day when he visited the Office of the Director of National Intelligence, when he made an insulting comment about how Russia has nothing other than nuclear weapons and oil, you know, the stuff that he picked up from the Obama years. And then, again, he brought up the interference in the 2022 election. And incidentally, if the Republicans do recapture the House and the Senate in 2022, you can bet that the media will go into overdrive blaming Russia for that, and then there'll be absolute hysteria within the United States that the Russians have stolen another election, and then we can say goodbye to any serious negotiations.
All right, thanks a lot, gentlemen. Journalist and political commentator Fred Weir joining us from Moscow. Also thanks to research fellow at Global Policy Institute George Samueli speaking to us from Budapest. And with that, it brings us to an end here on this edition of the News Review. Thanks, and see you soon.
Qadir Khum celebrates the divine appointment of Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him, the cousin and son-in-law of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, as Prophet Muhammad's vicegerent and successor. We here at Arabi English Radio congratulate all our Muslim listeners on the auspicious occasion of Eid al-Qadir.
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Whose Streets, directed by Saba Folayan and Damon Davis. And joining me in the studio, we have Rich Klein, who is the Vice Chair of the London Film Critics Circle and Chair of the Critics Circle Film Awards. And beside him is Lee Jasper, who is a former policing director for London and social justice campaigner. He is also a Black Sox sponsor, which was formed in 2015 as a result of events concerning the increasing levels of violence impacting London's black communities. Now, Whose Streets is an unflinching look at the Ferguson uprising in the US state of Missouri. The uprising sparked nationwide protests the day after the fatal shooting of Michael Brown by white police officer Darren Wilson on August 9, 2014. Now, filmed on the front line of the clashes, this documentary captures the explosions, the tear gas, and the military-style police vehicles up close. And at the same time, the film also manages to show the anger and sense of outrage that the heavy-handed response provoked.
Anybody growing up here, you tangibly know when you cross the county line, you got to drive a little differently. Your behavior changes because you know how policing changes.
Ferguson police just killed a man in front of my apartment.
People flooded in the area have some experience with police.
Things have never been right for black folks in America.
We're trying to mourn, and you came here with 300 cop cars, riot gear, and canine units.
You gonna shoot me too?
But that ain't the story that you hear about.
This is chemical warfare that you are not supposed to be able to use on U.S. soil.
This movement was born in love.
We are raising activists. If there's going to be any change, it starts with our children.
Welcome both of you to the show. Thanks very much for coming on. Now, this documentary provides a really great insight into the racial tensions of the black community in Ferguson and the police and the issue of police brutality is brought up. And we also get incredible access of the residents themselves who express their struggle from their point of view. Rich, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what was your take on Whose Streets?
The film is very specifically about Ferguson. It's not a general film about policing in America or Black Lives Matter or any of the bigger issues. It's very, very specifically about Ferguson. It does obviously touch on much bigger issues as a result. So it feels like a really important document, but it's not as easy to watch as a film. It doesn't have a central narrative line. It has a lot of great characters in it, people that it explores. But the thing that makes it really, really worth watching is the footage in it. It's full of incredibly shot footage on people's phones and their own private cameras, right on the streets, in the middle of all of these riots and all of the tensions and the back and forth of everything going on. So it's showing us a side of the story that the media never showed, because the media kind of took a very slanted view of this whole thing. And
the documentary highlights this. We'll
yeah,
see
the
a
documentary
bit later
shows
on.
The documentary contrasts the footage that was shot in the streets with what the media showed the public, and that's very interesting. And I think that makes the film definitely worth seeing.
So as Rich was saying, it is an incredibly big topic with lots of layers, especially on the issue of racism, police brutality, and American gun violence, and so forth. Lee, if I could turn to you now, what's your take on these sorts of films, and why are they important?
I think an important part of documentation of the struggle of ordinary communities against excessive police violence and institutionalized racism, and that part, you know, it forms an essential documentary narrative around detailing their particular stories from a human perspective. Each individual family is looked at and goes into some detail. So it really gives you the full 3D picture of what a community under pressure from police racism and violence looks like, feels like, smells like, how they respond personally, how it affects their personal lives and the communities around them. And for that, I think it's an important part of social documentary.
But as Rich was saying, this documentary largely focuses on Ferguson. Mm-hmm. But as we know, the African American community have been plagued by police brutality for decades. But what is it that made the Ferguson uprising so different?
I think it's a combination of things, really. I think that by the time 2014 comes along and the impact on new technology, on people's understanding of justice and struggle, and the extent to which we now see people capturing inappropriate policing incidents on their own mobile phones, gives this a unique feel, because it's from 1,001 different perspectives. If anything, this film is almost like a people's film made up of huge numbers of individual filmmakers who captured various scenes, and they've tried to knit it together in the way that has been described. So I think new technology, I think Hands Up, Don't Shoot, and the Black Lives Matter all emanated from it. I think people were tired of an Obama rhetoric which was about equality but seemed very little in terms of holding police to be accountable at a local level. And the images themselves were so deeply resonant of the black experience and the African-American experience in the United States as to sort of re-excite an embryonic civil rights movement. The scenes we saw on black and white and color pictures of police brutality and victims in Ferguson in 2014 could have been Ferguson 1964, yeah. And that was the power of their message.
And the power of relevance today, exactly. Yeah. And Rip, so one observer in the documentary calls the clash between the police and the black community a, quote, unseen war. And it's been reported that $11 million was reportedly spent on law enforcement connected to the Ferguson uprising. Do you think the film is successful in showing how aggressive the policing is?
I think it really does. I mean, it on the one side, it shows how these people just come to the street just saying, how can you shoot an unarmed teenager 10 times? How can the police do this and then try to pretend like it's not an issue? And then the police respond to them coming out into the streets with, I mean, what you saw in the clip was, you know, they're all standing in a line looking really menacing. But later on, they come out with full riot gear and dogs and, you know, snipers on the tops of these giant tanks that are rolling into the streets. It's pretty terrifying because the police just reacted as if the public, who are just desperately crying out saying, don't treat us like this. The police are reacting as if they're the villains. The general public are the villains. And the film really captures that sense that these people just feel desperate and they don't really have a choice but to riot. They start off with a quiet vigil. It's a candlelight vigil. And their voices get louder and louder and louder because nobody's listening to them. And the police are responding like that.
As it said in the film also, that Martin Luther King is quoted, yes, as saying the riots is the way, an act of showing the protest of the unheard. Now, Lee, what do you think of the militarization of the police? Is this an appropriate response to deal with the situation?
Well, it's not in a liberal democracy, in supposedly, you know, the land of the free. I think what we're seeing all over the world, really, in Western democracies, is increasing militarization. And in fact, most Western police services are almost following a sort of Israeli policing model. That seems to be the standard model, to be very heavily militarized. And to have the option of using overwhelming and overpowering force. The policing that we saw in Ferguson was akin to an invasion by a small army of a foreign occupying force seeking to invade another country. The combatants' language was the same, the imagery was the same, and I think it's a very dangerous precedent when the police force, and that's what it is, a force, can militarize itself using the advanced latest equipment available to them of any military in the world for use against civilians.
And it's exactly the point that you raised that, actually, because in the film we see an American Palestinian resident of Ferguson, and he used to live in the West Bank, and he said it's no different, the West Bank and Ferguson, in the way they're being treated. Do you think that's a fair point to make?
I think it is a fair point. I think if you look at the administration and dispensation of justice on the West Bank, Gaza, and you begin to look at Ferguson and other areas of the United States, you can see that an apartheid level of justice is being dispensed both in West Bank and in America. And to that extent, Israel and America share a similar approach to tackling minority groups that they dislike intensely, and that is to oppress and police them out of oblivion, really.
I want to talk quickly just how the police are portrayed in this documentary. We see the police officers wearing, some of them wearing bracelets for support for Darren Wilson, who shot Michael Brown. What did you make of this?
Well, I like the fact that they let them speak. It's not a purely one-sided documentary. It does kind of let people speak, but then the things the police said in reaction to this event and to the escalating violence were just all wrong. You know, they basically, they vilified Mike Brown. They showed, you know, a clip of him stealing something from a shop to say, oh, he was a hardened criminal. Well, it still doesn't mean that you can shoot him 10 times when he's unarmed in the back. I mean, that's crazy. The way that they spun the story and all of their press conferences and even the comments that they make to the cameras.
But they play the victim.
They play the victim. Themselves. And they act like they're the ones who are being attacked. And it's quite frightening, actually.
Sorry, Lee, you wanted to quickly add
something? I think what also hints to is the vast chasm of perceptions between sections of white America and sections of black America about the nature, scale, of racism and what it means. And I think there's a conversation there that is being conducted through megaphones around a awfully complex and nuanced issue that is reflected in the total lack of understanding, I think, from white America about the reality of racism as it affects African Americans, Latinos, Muslim, African Muslims, and so on and so forth in the USA. And
I don't think it's all of white America. I think there's a segment of white America that is just ignorant of the whole thing. There's quite a large segment that is aware of what's going on and is fighting.
I think I would agree with you, but I would say that
we
racial inequality.
We did see a lot of white people in the crowd in support of the black.
Yeah,
no, absolutely, and I think that's right. But I think that when you look at it over the course of history, that what you find is, despite whites having some theoretical acknowledgement of the existence of racism, racial inequality in America and the UK has gotten worse over every single measure. And so a rhetorical understanding of racism and a practical and a theoretical understanding that gives you the tools to deal with it are two separate things.
Okay, great points there.
This was actually the first camera that I got when I first started cop watching. I just put my stickers on it, you know, put a picture on my camera so when the police looking, they could see that cop watch stick on there. Got some walkie-talkies. This is two of them for me. So when I leave, I get one to my wife. So the cops don't come in Canfield like no more, like doing none of that crap. They do stranger stuff. And that's because we done changed. We made them change what they doing. That's all I want. You know, don't give them an opportunity to gun somebody down in the street. Be out there to watch them. I don't go out with no weapons or nothing like that. I go out with my camera, that's my weapon, you know, and the fact is that since the police are not being held accountable, we have to hold them accountable.
An endearing and inspirational character. Rich, what did you make of his story and progression?
I enjoyed his story. I like the fact that he's taking a positive approach to it. He's doing something that's really important, and the footage he's capturing is valuable in making sure that everyone understands what's really going on.
And Lee, what do you make of these sorts of initiatives? Do you think social media helps in the struggle for racial justice?
Incredibly. I think they've made a huge difference, actually, to the optics and the understanding of the reality of racism. And of course, what we saw as a consequence of that type of activism is years later, you know, in-depth studies that showed the Ferguson police force were operating a sort of income-driven arrest policy that targeted poor blacks. And they were almost financially incentivized to racially profile that community. And I think that the cameras and the people and social media and access to it allows our community to get its voice heard.
And Rich, we also see, speaking of cameras actually, we see the coverage of how the hostility of the black community to the mainstream media in this documentary. Yeah. Why do you think they were so hostile?
Well, because the mainstream media covered this as an incident of looting. You know, they didn't cover it as a policeman killed an unarmed teenager. They covered it as, you know, residents of Ferguson are looting their local shops. They covered the wrong story.
And Lee, I just wanted to get your thoughts on this. What do you think of the mainstream media coverage of sort of these movements, Black Lives Matter and police brutality?
I think we saw the same at the Grenfell Tower fire disaster post there, where the mainstream media descended on the community and they were very hostile to them. And I think it's largely because there are so few black and ethnic minority peoples in British newsrooms and US newsrooms. And even where they are there, the narrative seems to be overwhelmingly one of a sort of establishment elite perspective. And new technology and these films give us an absolute way of breaking through that moratorium of silence that we've had for so long, and allows these fresh voices for justice to percolate into the public consciousness. So I think it's an incredibly exciting time, and the internet may well be the thing that holds policing to account to a greater extent than anything else we've ever done.
So that's a, there's hope in the battle ahead then. That's great. So we're just going to take
as long
a brief break now from a discussion. I just want to read a statistic about US deaths by police gunfire. And by the Washington Post, it reported that at least 1,000 people were killed in 2017, and is on track to reach that level. Lee, why do you think the issue of police brutality is such a big problem in the US?
I think it's largely because of the failure of US justice system to deliver, you know, equitable justice for people who suffered from grievous police assault and brutality. There's been systematic cover-up of those sorts of abuses. We've seen that year after year. 1,000 people dying in 2017. Those are the numbers you expect in a small war somewhere very distant. And it shows the extent to which the process of Jim Crow policing, and that's what it is, it's a Jim Crow-style policing without all of the formality of policy and legislation, but producing equally iniquitous outcomes, is the reality for most black experiences in America. Two-tier justice, apartheid levels of administration of justice, and a gross denial of the reality of racism that just angers and inflames disadvantaged communities.
And in the documentary, we see various references to President Obama at the time, and we get the sense of the frustration that the residents were powerless, even with a black president, that they couldn't get their justice. What did you make of this?
Well, I mean, they say he's not a black president, which is very telling. It's a very telling thing for them to say, because they feel like he's not sticking up for them. I'm not sure how much power he has to intervene in a local clash like that. And he did initiate an investigation into it, which did result in the finding that that police force was systemically racist. But then every investigation into every race, every police force in America has come up with that same in every city all over the entire country, from Los Angeles to, you know, I mean everywhere. So it's a problem in the entire nation. And I think you know, like you were saying, It's a nation that's never really dealt with slavery.
Absolutely.
They made it illegal 150 years ago, and then they never really got rid of it.
That's right.
And they've just changed it into a system of, you know, oppressive policing and marginalization, and it's that system that's carried on.
And people are
just now saying we're not going to put up with this anymore.
And then fast forward to today's president, we have Donald Trump, who has been criticized for encouraging police brutality, saying that the police are being too nice. What do you think of Trump's role, Lee, in race relations and police brutality?
Well, Trump is the original white Anglo-Saxon Protestant white privileged man-in-chief. He uses the bully boy pulpit in Charlottesville. He backed the fascists. He seemed completely unapologetic for the murder of an anti-fascist demonstrator by fascists in that area. He subsequently made his views known in relation to Muslims and African Americans. I mean, there can be no doubt. There are lots of people saying, oh, well, maybe Donald will mature with age or somehow become more nuanced by the politics of Washington. He's become more extreme, more discriminatory, and in fact encapsulates the very worst aspects of a sort of white supremacist, male, bigoted patriarchy that has somehow, through the dint of wealth and corruption, found its way to the top job in the United States. It's a disgrace for the country. It's a threat to the world. And it is emboldening and enlivening fascists and racists all over the world. So when Donald comes to the United Kingdom, I expect the whole of the European alt-right to turn out to counter any demonstrations we must put out. That's how dangerous this man is.
I'm afraid we'll have to end on that powerful note, Lee. Thank you to both my guests and to you. I've been Camille Shambiati.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via internet, shortwave, medium wave, FM, and satellites. Our listeners in Indian subcontinent can listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 41 meters, 7,410 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to English service of the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave, 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz, every day from 19:20 to 20:20 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our program via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat, or BAT 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program P.O. Box 19395-6767 Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. The program is Dialogue, and I'm your host, Mahdi. Today we want to talk about one of the great personalities in the early history of the Muslims, Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam. Please stay tuned. Imam Muhammad al-Baqir was the direct descendant of the Holy Prophet Muhammad, and he was the fifth divinely appointed imam among the household of the Holy Prophet. He was the son of the fourth divinely appointed imam, Imam Ali ibn al-Husayn alayhi salam. Now all historians and traditionalists of Islam are unanimous that among the descendants of Imam Hassan and Imam Husayn, a maximum of religious sciences were expounded by Imam Muhammad al-Baqir. That is why the title of al-Baqir was given to the Imam, which denotes one who splits knowledge. Imam al-Baqir contributed greatly to the science of Quranic exegesis, scholastic theory, religious law, and Islamic jurisprudence, among many other subjects.
قال الإمام الباقر عليه السلام وجدت في الكتاب يعني كتابا لعلي عليه السلام أن قيمة كل امرئ وقدره معرفته إن الله تبارك وتعالى يحاسب الناس على قدر ما آتاهم من العقول في دار الدنيا.
Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam stated, I found written in the book which is ascribed to Imam Ali alayhi salam that the worth and value of every man is his knowledge. Verily, Allah, blessed and most high, will take people to account according to his intellects that he has given them in this world's life.
Welcome back, dear friends. It's an honor and a blessing to have you with us on the program. You're listening to Dialogue on IRIB English Radio. Dear friends, we find in the beautiful conversations and the dialogues of Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, peace be upon him, this divinely appointed Imam, selected by Allah himself. We find in the conversations of Imam al-Baqir these beautiful words of wisdom, these golden conversations, if you will. And so in one of these conversations, in one of these dialogues, that Imam al-Baqir was having with his companion, he put forth a very interesting statement, which I would like to share with you all. Imam al-Baqir says, "Do not make friends with the sinner." Now, dear friends, if we want to talk just a little bit about this beautiful statement from Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam, which he said in this conversation with his companion, talking about what kind of friends are good friends and what kind of friends are really not considered your friends. He said this idea, or he said this statement, excuse me, to not make friends with the sinner. Now, here are just a few points that we need to keep in mind. First and foremost is, well, why should we not be friends with a sinner, right? Well, here, dear friends, when you become friends with somebody who is habitually, consistently, continuously indulging in sins, or is committing sins, is committing haram, prohibited actions, then of course this will influence you. There's a very famous saying which goes, "Birds of a feather flock together," right? Or, "One bad apple makes the bushel go bad." So in the same sense, when you are friends with somebody who is committing evil deeds, somebody who does not fear disobeying Allah, this will influence you as an individual, and it will take you down a path which leads to the disobedience and eventually the wrath of Allah. So being friends with a sinner is definitely, definitely not a good thing. Now, for example, we might have a friend who, you know, every now and then, sometimes they slip up and they might commit a mistake, they might commit an error. In this situation, if you feel that your influence for good will be higher than their influence towards bad, then yes, you can be their friend. So, for example, by you being their friend, you will be able to perhaps, you know, help them come towards the good and righteous path. And likewise, their sinning or their disobedience of Allah will by no means influence you in disobeying Allah. If you keep these things in mind, then yes, there's no problem to be friends with such a person. Of course, don't be naive and think that, you know, you will be able to make everybody better no matter how bad they are. That is kind of a risky thing to do, but we always keep it to what the Imam has taught us, which is to not make friends with the sinner. This is Dialogue, Imam al-Baqir alayhi salam.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parstoday.com.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir. La ilaha illallah. La ilaha illallah.
And now we invite you to listen to Sayyid Muhammad Ridhvi.
one or two, incidents from his life about his akhlaq, just to learn the seerah of the imam, is the issue of, sabr, patience in dealing with the people who are rude to you. And we see this example in the life of the Prophet, in the life of Amir al-Mu'mineen, in the example of Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, Imam Zain al-Abidin. But since we are remembering the fifth Imam, let us look at his example, where somebody, and it seems, people had been brainwashed against the Ahlul Bayt. And this individual was from Ahlul Kitab, either a Christian or a Jew, we don't know. And he was an Arab. We're talking about Ahl Kitab from the Arab community. And he says, Anta ibn Sawda al-Zanjiyya al-Bawiyya, na'uzu billah. And this was not even true. He says, you are a son of a Zanji, Zanji is more Zanjibari, African, from an African lady, a black lady. And remember, who is the mother of our fifth Imam? Among all the Imams, he is known as Alaviyun Bain al-Alaviyin. He is the only pure Alavi among the Imams. Because all others, their mothers are from other families. His father is Imam Zain al-Abidin, and his mother is Fatima bint Hassan. So they are cousins. Son of Imam Hussein, daughter of Imam Hassan. These are the parents of our fifth Imam. So there's no issue of using these kinds of language for her at all. But even then, lam yaghdhab al-imam, imam did not become angry. Because he realized that this person has been brainwashed. It's not that his evilness is, from his nature. No, he has been told wrong things about me and about Ahlul Bayt. And so Imam then says, well, whatever you are saying about my mother, if it be true, may Allah forgive her. Because the last term, al-Bawiyya, was not a good term. And if you are wrong in what you are saying, may Allah forgive you. And that is where this person realized, I'm trying again and again to insult him, to provoke him, to make him angry. But he is responding at all these situations, with politeness. And this was actually the basis of this person who came with this wrong impression of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir as the descendant of Ali, the way they have been told about Ali and Ali Ali. This politeness and akhlaq of our fifth Imam changed a Ahle Kitab enemy into a Muslim and a Shia of Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salatu wassalam.
Thank you very much, dear friends, for listening to this episode of Dialogue. Don't forget to log on to our website at parstoday.com. Until another episode, God bless you and fi amanillah.
You heard was an IRIB English radio program. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.